The first case on our calendar, 04-1668, State of Ohio, Ex-Rel Ohio Congress of Parents and Teachers versus the State of Ohio Board of Education. Mr. Mooney.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
I'm Don Mooney. I'm here on behalf of a group of plaintiffs, including the Ohio PTA and others concerned about the future of public education in Ohio. More than 150 years ago, the delegates to the 1851 Constitutional Convention chose some words that you're required to interpret in deciding this case. They said that a separate system of privately owned, they said that the state of Ohio had to build a single system of common schools that would be thorough and efficient to educate our Ohio school children. At the time, they were confronted by a hodgepodge of competing public and private schools, all fighting for public resources and students. Now, 150 years later, we're here because the Ohio General Assembly has chosen to spend $424 million each year, this last year, more the coming year, on a separate system of privately owned, privately managed public schools, not subject to the same standards as our regular public schools.
Privately owned?
They are, Your Honor. The assets of the community schools are privately owned by private nonprofit corporations or public benefit corporations. Some of them own their own buildings and assets, others lease them from for-profit management companies such as White Hat.
Is that a savings for the state of Ohio?
It depends, Your Honor. If they stay open, I suppose they could save some money. But as we've seen in recent years, as the schools close, the investment is lost altogether. What happens is and we've had, I think, 26 of these privately owned community schools close over the last 3 or 4 years, what happens is that the assets are lost. Either the company that leased them to the community school takes them back, or debtors take them back. And although the legislature has passed some laws saying money is first supposed to go to the state teacher's retirement system, often what happens is there's no money there, and somehow that money has to be made up to teachers, to creditors, and so on. So the state's investment can be lost. This court in the DeRolf decision decided that the public schools of Ohio, to be thorough and efficient, had to operate under a uniform system of standards. And that's another problem that we have with these community schools. They are not subject to the same statewide uniform standards that regular public schools have been subject to.
What about homeschooling?
Pardon me?
What about homeschooling? What standards are they subject to?
Well, I think that homeschooling is a different kettle of fish altogether, Your Honor, and I would agree that homeschoolers have been essentially cut out of the standards. The state legislature had said if you want to follow some rules, very minimal rules for homeschooling, you can do that. But the key is the General Assembly is not spending money.
And that would be true also with any of the religious, the parochial schools.
That's right.
Because they're not receiving any state money. And that is really the distinguishing factor in any of these other schools, opposed to the community or charter schools.
Right, right. Exactly, Your Honor. The concept set forth in the Constitution in 1851 was that there was going to be a common system funded on a uniform basis with uniform standards by the state of Ohio. And I know you struggled with those issues in the DeRolf case, but the bottom line from our perspective is that it certainly does not permit the creation of this separate system of privately owned and managed schools. The
Council,
sure.
Could you take us to the what you see as the minimum constitutional threshold of the thorough and efficient?
Okay.
I'm not clear whether you were arguing that a intermixed system if the same standards were to apply, let me mm-hmm. put it this way, and then you sort out what is the, you see there's a constitutional threshold. If the community schools or charter schools were subject to the same degree of oversight, minimum standards of achievement, same sanctions or intervention if that's not achieved as the public schools, and if there were no diversion or no penalty to the property tax for the removal of students from the public schools and placed in the community schools, would that violate the constitutional threshold? And what do you see as the constitutional threshold?
I think the constitutional threshold is it has to be a single system. It has to be common. Common is the same as public. I think that if you look at that 1933 Attorney General opinion that's attached to the state's second brief, you can go through that and see that in the Attorney General's view at that time, and I think it was consistent with the history, common schools or public schools were administered by public agencies created by law or by public officials. So I think the key is public accountability. I don't think that the state of Ohio can delegate to a private corporation the ability to operate what then is described in the legislation as a public school. It's not a public school if it's administered by private entities, if it's managed by a for-profit corporation. And I think that
so
is
you're,
the key.
You're attacking the structure and not just the, because you present a lot of facts
right.
about the damage to the public school system that the diversion of dollars
right.
is and so my question goes to, if there were no damage in terms of drainage of funds from the public
right.
schools, and the legislature just chose to also provide some financing, whether we have the vouchers for the mm-hmm. The non-publics or whether it's some system like this where private for profit or private for non-profit get some money additionally, would that violate the constitutional threshold?
I think if you don't have some direct public official involvement in the administration of the school, it's not a public school. I mean, I think that in the Attorney General's opinion, as an example, he talks about public schools as being administered by public officials. So what does administer mean? If you look at Black's Law Dictionary, it means to operate, to manage. It doesn't mean to regulate. You know, I think what we have now is a system where you have these privately owned schools that get public money. They are regulated by sponsors who are now private entities. They can be charitable foundations. They get a 3% payback for their role as sponsors. The Ohio Department of Education now plays a very remote role in actually regulating these schools. In theory, the ODE regulates the sponsors who regulate these privately owned and managed schools. And I think until you have some public accountability, some public official responsible for managing those schools, they are not common or public schools. Now, some of my other counts we can resolve by changing the funding. But I think the fundamental issue is here, $424 million spent on privately owned and managed schools are not part of a common system of public education.
Council, could you help us with, there's a mixture of procedural
sure.
issues in this case. And you're the appellee on the issues of Judge McGrath said that DeRolf was somehow race
right.
judicata.
Right.
I don't for the life of me understand that. Could you?
And
the Court of Appeals rejected that.
Right. And I don't think this court even took that issue. I think the state tried to raise that issue. I think the bottom line is, if I had to put it in a nutshell, they were arguing below that DeRolf somehow controlled the issue of whether charter schools violated Article 6, Section 2, but DeRolf was decided, in essence, before the charter schools were created. So, we just never thought it made sense, and the Court of Appeals agreed that res judicata did not apply, and I think this court decided not even to take that issue.
Well, this case was bifurcated on just constitutional issues
right.
at the trial level. Am I right about that?
Well, what the court said is, let's see what issues we can resolve without having discovery. So,
and there has been no discovery.
There has been no discovery other than some document production by the state early on.
And your argument is that money's been diverted from the local property fund by virtue of these charter schools,
right.
and they're maintaining that there isn't any. So isn't that a factual issue
I think that has become a factual issue. I think originally we moved for summary judgment on that. I think they moved to dismiss.
Do we even have a final appealable order here?
Oh, I think we do on the constitutional issues. The Court of Appeal, the constitutional issues are that can be decided and that there is a final order on is whether or not as a matter of law, the creation of this separate system of public schools violates Article 6, Section 2. I think on the funding issues, which are separate and apart, there are factual issues, and I think it's appropriate to remand those back to the
So
to
we're
the
only
trial
really
court.
Going to decide a little bit of this case, and the rest of it is...
Well, if you agree with us that these privately owned and privately managed community schools are not part of a common system of public schools, then we don't have to go back, because I think the case is over, and I think you lay out what the law requires, and the General Assembly would have to figure out a way to if they want to create charter schools that comply with the law. I think there are some ways to do that, as we just talked.
Well, I didn't think there's any factual issue about whether local property taxes are affected here. Are they? The appellee, the state's brief, as you know, goes to great lengths to explain how the state funds apply to the school districts and how money is obviously diverted to a community school when a student leaves the traditional school, but the local property taxes are not affected, are they? That's not a factual issue, is it?
Well,
it's illegal.
I think the Court of Appeals said it was a factual issue, and I think it is, because at this point, I'm not disputing how they run the numbers. Mr. Gagan, who's the treasurer of the Cincinnati Public
Schools. But the law provides, there's law on what happens to real estate taxes that are collected in a school district, is there not? That's not a factual issue.
There's no factual issue that the community schools get a check that comes from the state of Ohio. And if that's all that is of concern to the court, then we lose on that issue. But I think if you look at the practical consequences, look at it from the point of view of school administrators in Cincinnati and Akron and Cleveland, they get that SF3 form, and it shows that they are losing money from the state and local share. This, as you know from your DeRolf cases, a basic grant of money for each child comes from a combination of local real estate taxes and state funds, and it varies from district to district. In our view, when that community school student gets the entire amount of the grant and it's deducted from the SF3 form, the funds that go from the state to the local school district, they're taking part of that local taxes.
But,
now, I know we disagree with that, and if all the issue is where does the check come from, we'd lose on that issue.
Well, certainly the proportion of support for the local schools changes if state funds are withdrawn. If five students leave a school district or leave a traditional school and go to a community school or a private school or they leave the district altogether, the proportion of support from the real estate tax increases, the proportion of support,
right.
but not the dollar amount. Is there any question about that?
I have a question about it, but I have a great deal of trouble trying to track all these dollars down. And I think the Court of Appeals did as well and said that it's a question of fact that we can't resolve on this motion. So
let me ask you, Mr. Mooney, do we know from the record how many of these schools, the community schools, are 200 whatever they are, 240 or I don't know, maybe there are more
Close
now.
To 297.
297. How many of them are, they all have to have a sponsor.
Right.
And local school districts can sponsor a community school. Do we know from the record how many of those schools are sponsored by local school districts?
Right. The record has it, and I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's around 20. And the record will have that, and I'm sorry I can't provide it to you.
Only
off the top
20
of my head.
School districts that
20, there are 20,
that are sponsors,
I think approximately or? 20 community schools are sponsored by school districts. And I think that, you know, we're not challenging the notion that if you had community schools that were regulated or sponsored by a local school district, that would be one way of getting around this problem of the non-common schools, because there is local accountability.
Well, those school districts must have, I'm sure this is a constitutional issue or not, but those school districts must have decided that it's somehow to their benefit to have a community school in
right.
their district.
And I think,
and
we think that helps solve the problem.
Often it's because they put special students in those schools. They have arts and those kind of things. They're special schools. They're not your
right.
ordinary public school.
The local elected officials are then deciding that this structure makes sense, and therefore there is some degree of local accountability, which we think helps solve the problem.
You can keep talking while we're asking questions.
Okay, that's fine. I don't want to.
The red light. I'll tell you when to sit down. or when you may sit down.
I'll let you know.
You'd like to go now, I know. But doesn't that, you're arguing that as part of your constitutional argument, that there's a diversion of funds of state, let's say at least state funds here,
right.
To a community school that is, however it's operated, however we describe it, that somehow hurts the traditional school district. But if school districts are sponsors and saying, we want a community school, for the reasons that, such as Justice Resnick suggested, doesn't that defeat your argument?
I don't think it defeats the argument, because I think what we're saying is, if all of the charter schools in Ohio, if the law was written in a way that says you can have charter schools in Ohio, and they can be created when a local school district sponsors the school, I think that would solve our problem. I think we'd still have to go back to the issue of having the same standards apply. And I think the same standards should apply to those schools that are sponsored by local school districts as are sponsored by anyone else, as our regular public schools. So the standards issue is still there. But the issue of are they public schools is not there, because in our view, they are then subject to the administration and control of public officials, i.e. the local school board.
So, go ahead.
So really you're arguing about the statute, the way the statutes are created, rather than the concept itself as being constitutional or not. If I understand you,
right.
you're not arguing with the concept insofar as the General Assembly may have the opportunity to provide charter schools that are thorough and efficient, but you're arguing that the way that they have gone about it is a problem.
I think you could have constitutional charter schools. I don't think that and one example would be if you give to the local school boards the ability to sponsor and regulate and create a charter school that would be, as an example, oriented to a special type of program or a special need of student, because there you have the local elected officials who are accountable and responsible for making sure that the schools are run properly, in addition to standards created statewide. So if you had charter schools that were subject to the same statewide standards, and if they were accountable to local elected school boards, that could work. But that's not the system we have in Ohio. And I think you have to look at the system that we have, which is this system where we have these private sponsors, we have privately owned charter schools that are privately managed, many of them, half of them, I think now, about $200 million goes to for-profit management companies that are in charge of these schools. Those are not, in the minds of the folks who wrote that Constitution in 1851, those are not common or public schools.
Counsel, before you sit down, could you paint a picture of are these schools K through 12, or are they principally elementary schools? Size, range of size, average size?
There's a mishmash of them. Some are only elementary, some are middle schools, some K to 12, some are just high schools. We've referenced in our brief these life skill centers that White Hat operates that are high schools essentially, although our complaint is they don't have to.
And they're principally urban, but some not.
And most of them are physically located, if they are physical schools, in urban districts. There are also these internet-based cyber schools that are drawing, I think, 13,000 children statewide. They can be from any district, essentially, because they don't need a brick-and-mortar building, but they get the same amount of money as a brick-and-mortar school.
Well, your brief outlines facts which show achievement at substantially below the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible result? Is it possible that the result there is because they are attracting children who are failing or just dropping would be dropouts in the public schools, and so the range of population is below normal to begin with. Is that possible?
I think that's possible. It's also possible, if you look at the statistics, that it's because they have less qualified teachers. We have some statistics in our brief that came from Ohio State showing that that the charter school teachers have significantly lower levels of master's degrees, that many of them, I think close to 40%, simply have temporary teaching certificate licenses. There's a huge turnover, 44% of teachers turn over every year. And then finally, they have larger class sizes. There's an average of 30 kids per each charter school's teacher. So as compared to 19 in regular public schools.
And is it too soon to know the dropout rate as compared with the urban public schools?
I've not seen any statistics on that.
All right.
Mr. Mooney, we're keeping you with your red light on, but I have the question that seems to me to be your strongest point is the governance of the schools. You argue that the school boards need to be that the community schools need to somehow be governed by public officials. Give me your strongest argument on where in the Constitution, how Constitution do you find support? I read your briefs, obviously, but
sure.
What's your strongest argument on the constitutional support for that argument? It seems to me, as you know, the appellees argue that the General Assembly has the authority in the Constitution to create school districts, common schools, and that they have a good bit of latitude in doing that.
I think it comes from what does the word common school mean? And you go back to 1851 and you look at the history at that time. Professor O'Brien did, I think, a very interesting article. We've also included in the record transcripts from the Constitutional Convention. I think common school at that time was understood to be, and this is also in the 1933 Attorney General's opinion, which was more contemporary than what we may have today in terms of 1851. Common school is a public school, and it means that it's owned by the public, it's administered by public officials, either elected or appointed by public agencies, and that's not what we have here. So that is the gist of our argument on why these have to be more closely administered by actual public officials, not private entities.
Then, Counsel, your take here is that the word system truly is only inclusive of one model within that system, and the latitude is not there with the legislature to create other models that could be included within the word system.
Right, and I think that comes once again from the history in 1851 that said they had this hodgepodge of competing systems subject to a variety of standards. Some were publicly funded, some were a combination of private and public funds, and they said we need a common system that works throughout the state of Ohio. When this court looked at that provision in DeRolf, it went out of its way to say it needs to be the common system needs to be subject to a uniform statewide system of strictly enforced standards. And both of those are problems here because of the separate standards that apply to community schools.
So you would not agree that if the same standards were applicable, the same testing and consequences were part of the system of the community schools, it still wouldn't meet your definition?
I think to solve the problem, you need to be subject to the same standards, and there needs to be more direct administrative role for public officials, whether that's because they're accountable to local school boards, or some other model that I'm not going to try to invent for you here today. But I think this system, I mean, unfortunately, you can only decide the case before you. This system has two defects under Article 6, Section 2. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mooney. Mr. Riedler.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Chad Riedler on behalf of the community school defendants. To enhance the thoroughness and efficiency of its public school system, Ohio enacted a community school program. The United States Supreme Court has already described the program as part of a broader undertaking by the state to enhance the educational options of Ohio school children living in low-performing school districts in our state. This year, the schools enroll over 60,000 children, many of whom are failing or were dissatisfied with their traditional public school. And I would like to start first with our proposition of law number one, the plaintiff's proposition of law number one, and the issue that Justice Pfeiffer raised, which is the common schools question. And clearly there is no doubt that community schools are common schools. Now this court said in the Simmons-Harris case that the common school requirement means that the state is required to set up a system of public schools and is barred from setting up a system of non-public schools. But clearly community schools are public schools, and the first place to start is 3314.01, which clearly states that community schools are public schools and part of the state's system of education.
So, Counsel, you're saying by the fact that the legislature created the community schools, that is enough to bring them within the nomenclature of common schools?
Well, that's part of the answer, Justice O'Connor. But it's also true that these schools carry every indicia of a public entity. They don't discriminate. They hire state-certified teachers. They're publicly funded. They don't charge tuition. There's no entrance exams. And I think most importantly, they're non-sectarian.
Are they governed by the same standards as the public schools?
Well, they are, Justice O'Donnell. Now, to be sure, all schools across the state have some differences in terms of inputs. Traditional public schools have schools that focus on sciences or arts or are vocational in nature. But when it comes to the outputs for every public school in the state, they're the same. All community schools take proficiency tests, they take graduation tests, they take achievement tests, they receive report cards, they're publicly audited.
Do they take the same tests?
They are the same tests.
They are the same.
They are the same tests.
What about the certification of the teachers? Are their qualifications the same?
They have to be state, the teachers have to be state certified under 3314 to teach.
My question was, are they?
I believe they are, Justice Resnick.
You have a constitutional provision that talks about these public schools shall be set up by law for organization, administration, and control. But then it has this phrase that says, provided each school district has the power of referendum, the number and organization, Board of Education. You have a phrase that describes a Board of Education that is elected by the public. Now, there is nothing that gives any power to that board, and that's one of your arguments, I understand, but it's very difficult to read that constitutional provision in total and understand how the state legislature can create a subset of public schools that have no accountability to any local board. There's nowhere in that statute that separates out those two and says, you can have A, and then you can have B with school boards. What's your strongest argument as to why these schools should not be subject to a school board? Because that's, I think, the strongest argument they have is we'd be okay with community schools if the school boards were also in control of them. What's your strongest argument as to how you get around that phrase in the Constitution?
Justice Stratton, Article 6, Sections 2 and 3 are very specific. They authorize the state to organize and administer a public school system. And when it comes to school boards, in Article 6, Section 3, it's a very narrow requirement that only city school districts, it doesn't say all school districts, it says school districts within a city must have an elected school board. So first of all, it doesn't say that every school district in the state has to have an elected school board. It's only certain school districts. And it also doesn't say that every school has to have an elected school board.
But ironically, your current community schools are only allowed in urban districts, in city districts.
That's true. They do operate primarily in urban districts where the challenges have been greatest in terms of those faced by traditional public schools. But I think a fair reading of that provision is that only city school districts are required to have school boards. And the legislature made very clear that community schools are independent of any school district and are not, in fact, school districts themselves. And I think this would be a pretty wide and expansive reading of the Constitution to say that every district or every school in the state has to have an elected school board. That's not supported by Article 6, Section 3. Now, I would like to also address the thorough and efficient claims that have been raised. And these are the claims that the Court of Appeals said should go back to the trial court.
Counsel, before you get to that, let me just ask you to expand a little bit on what you just responded to Justice Stratton. You're saying that city schools require constitutionally a school board, and you're saying these schools are not city schools, so they don't require the school board. I mean, in a nutshell, that's your argument here.
Well, the Constitution says any school district located, I think, any school district located within the city.
Within the city has to have the school board.
And these are not city school districts.
So because they are legislatively carved out and established independent of the city school district, they don't, even though they're situated in the cities, isn't that kind of a circuitous argument there?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that the state is the ultimate arbiter of education policy. A school board's a creature of statute, but what the Constitution says, particularly Article 6, Section 2, and the first phrase in Section 3, is that the state is authorized to create and administer and organize a public school system. And the state is the one that has the responsibility and the duty to arrange the school programs as it sees fit. And there's a very narrow limitation on the state that to the extent that the state has created city school districts, that those city school districts have to be run by elected boards. Now, as to the thorough and efficient clause, the claims that the appeals court remanded, we believe that there's no basis here for a viable, thorough, and efficient claim. And keep in mind that before DeRolf, the court had never authorized a thorough and efficient claim or never accepted one, and had always deferred to the state legislature in setting education policy. And in DeRolf, the court recognized that in the narrow circumstance where there's
What about the Walters case? I thought the court looked at that exact thing in the Walters case, determined that the Constitution was being complied with, but certainly entertained the examination of that question.
Well, that is true, but that case, like the DeRolf case, was a widespread, to quote DeRolf was a widespread.
Well, you just said this court never looked at that question.
Well, it never accepted it. It never struck down the state's education.
That's a different proposition than whether or not it examined the constitutionality.
Well, even accepting that is true, Justice Piper.
Okay, while you're on this, before sure. you get too far, here's the dilemma I see for the state. Obviously, the concept is popular. Parents are voting with their feet and taking their kids to charter schools. But the state, from a constitutional standpoint, is here in this court already standing in a deep hole from which it has not yet extricated itself. That is that this court has determined four times that the state method of funding schools, pursuant to this very clause that you're describing, is unconstitutionally defective. That's the posture of the state. You're running an unconstitutional system at the present time. Now the legislature's response so far has been basically to tweak it, but to ignore this court. Now you're back with an overlay trying to help in the urban school districts. Well, I'll grant you, it's always seemed to me the most persuasive argument that we were not providing a thorough and efficient system of common schools is in the urban school districts because of the dropout rate and the low achievement rates. And they're trying to attack that by setting up a system that runs counter to the admonitions from this court with respect to DeRolf. That is, every time a child leaves the public school system for the community school, the state takes, $5,000 some odd dollars?
That's Correct.
Which far exceeds, in many cases, the number of state dollars that were being awarded to that school district for that child. You would agree that with that, would you not? It's about a 2-for-1 on average. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I would agree that only state money is deducted from that district.
Okay, but the result is, for every child that moves, state funding for the equivalent of two children moves with that child. That's the cost to the incumbent municipal urban school district that's already struggling with all these problems. Now, the net result of that is a greater reliance instead of a lower reliance on the real estate taxes, in direct conflict with the admonitions of this course. And the bottom line result is, for example, here in Columbus, you live here, you know what's going on. They're proposing to close 13 schools. So you're taking away the community-based school that the urban school district supplies as a result of moving children into these smaller and therefore more attractive to the families and to the students' schools. If that were an overlay that wasn't costing the incumbent school districts, that might make sense and be defensible from a constitutional standpoint. But I think you have a terrible mountain to climb from a constitutional standpoint when you haven't corrected the decisions in DeRolf.
Well, a couple of answers to that. And by the way, the state's lawyer will be arguing this morning as well, and I do want to reserve some time for him. But I did not read this case as a reopening of DeRolf in terms of a statewide challenge to the entire state.
I'm not
program.
Suggesting that. I'm just suggesting that the net result runs counter to DeRolf.
Let me disagree with that on a couple of fronts. First of all, community schools, of course, are entirely funded by the state, which is very consistent with DeRolf's notion that the state should play a greater role in funding public schools in our state. But second, in the example you talked about, the urban districts, on average, and both parties have addressed
this. Well, how do you compete? The community school funded 100% by the state. The local school now funded even in a greater proportion by the local property
right,
tax.
Right, I understand.
Which has to get the approval of the voters.
Well, I understand your question, Justice Pfeiffer. Both parties in this case have talked about how funding works. In the traditional Big Eight urban districts spend on average about $8,000 a student. Now, when a student leaves for a community school, the state will deduct, as you mentioned, $5,500 from their state allotment. But that district still keeps the remaining $7,000 to spend among their students remaining in that district.
You said they spend eight.
They spend 12. I'm sorry, they spend 12 if I misspoke. The average.
You didn't misspeak. You say they spend 12.
The average urban district per year, take Cincinnati for example, that's been one that's addressed significantly in the briefs, spends on average about $12,000 a student. Now, if that student would leave for a community school, they would lose $5,500 in state funding. But they would have approximately $7,000, $6,000 of funds remaining that they would have spent on that student that they can now spend on the remaining
you
students.
You want to use Cincinnati? What's the state funding per pupil in Cincinnati?
Well, the state, I don't know the exact per pupil amount. The state as a whole sends, I think, maybe $100 million to the district. But
what is it per pupil?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, isn't that the rub?
No, Justice Pfeiffer, the court has looked at a couple of issues here. For one, on the property tax issue, the state has looked at this from a statewide, or the court has looked at this from a statewide perspective, and said that the statewide system as a whole cannot become more reliant on property taxes. But that is true. It does not become more reliant as a whole on property taxes. Now, since certain individual districts may become more reliant on property taxes, the court has not recognized that as a constitutional violation. The point I was making is that per student funding actually goes up in urban suburban districts when a student leaves for community school because none of the local property taxes leave with it. And if any schools in the state would have an argument that there isn't a thorough and efficient problem, it's the community schools. The community schools receive on average about $6,500 to run their schools. And the competing urban districts receive about $12,000 total to run their schools. If I could, I'd like to allow the state to use our remaining time.
Thank you, Mr. Raylor. Mr. Carney.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Nothing in the Ohio Constitution prevents the General Assembly from offering parents and students educational choice within the public school system. Now, I'll try to address as many points as I can about funding and governance and standards, but I want to stress two overarching legal principles that govern all of these claims. First is that these are constitutional claims, and their claims sound best when they make sort of a free-floating claim about funding being unfair in general. But when you try to pin it down to a particular clause, is that part of their thorough and efficient argument, or is that part of their Article 6, Section 3, or is that part of their Article 12? That's when their claims fall apart, that they can't really show that they win on any one constitutional clause, so they sort of mix them all together. And the second overarching legal principle is that all of the claims here, the constitutional ones, not the statutory claims that were left behind in the trial court, but the constitutional claims can and should all be resolved as a matter of law, because as Chief Justice Moyer noted, the so-called disagreements about the formula and the funding are all answered in the statute. There's nothing, there's no witness you could call on the stand other than someone who could walk you through the statutes, and that's something this court can and should do, as the trial court judge did, is look at the statute and say, here's how the funding works, that is or isn't a problem. We'd say it's not, of course. And that's the end of that claim. Now, that doesn't mean that if they can't show facts that this school X or that school X is violating this or that rule, they can get mandamus, they can try to order us to shut down that school or stop funding that school or do something to us or to make the state act against a school. But the system as a whole, the question is the statute constitutional? And it is. Let's take these claims one at a time. Under the thorough and efficient clause, they've got basically three parts to it. That the funding violates thorough and efficient, that the governance does, and that the standards do. Let's take them one at a time. The funding, as Justice Pfeiffer noted, they're not real clear. Is there objection to the fact that, darn it, that school down the street gets money, even if we weren't hurt at all? Or is there objection more to the fact that here's how much we lose, that there's any penny loss, or to the amount? And if you break it apart, they fail on each point. They themselves admit that this funding would be the same if a community school is run by the school board. So why, if it hurts so much, when you lose a student and the money associated with that kid, why, if it hurts so much, would you open up your own if you're saying, gee, I'm bleeding myself dry?
Why so here's why. The urban school districts, not just in this state, but across the country, are blessed with tremendous social economic challenges that the children that come to school. The urban school districts traditionally are huge. They're giant bureaucracies with big school buildings in which it is very difficult for families to have a sense of community, a sense of ownership. And it seems to me that's and there are now studies and that's going on in some of the urban school districts is trying to break things up and make them smaller and more personal to the people that they're trying to serve. That is probably the fundamental. Certainly, when you look at the test results, it can't be the test results of the community schools that are driving people to them. It is that smallness, that sense of ownership. But the constitutional problem, it seems to me, is the way the legislature has overlaid this, and you can talk about this fact or that fact, but the end result, bottom line, is that they're taking away state funds at a rate that exceeds the dollars that follow a particular student, and thereby placing an even greater reliance on the property tax in school districts that have enormous fundamental problems. That's, it seems to me, the constitutional issue.
Well, the constitutional issue on the funding, let me correct a misstatement and perhaps a misunderstanding. When the schools are funded by the state and the localities together, it's a myth that sort of when each kid shows up, they kick in 40 cents and we kick in 60, 65 in Cleveland, we kick in about 40% in Cincinnati. It's a myth that each child gets sort of this mix. What really happens is they get a fixed amount from their millage, and from there, the state then fills the gap so that we pay the full $5,500 for each marginal student. So the question is, let's say you have two children, one in a community, one in a traditional, and the next year they just switch places. Well, in our book, it makes sense. Well, that kid takes $5,500 and that kid takes $5,500. They both cross the street together. If they were somehow right that the kid coming into the traditional school brings with them $5,500, but the student leaving should only take with them somehow $3,000, then that would mean every time they had transfers that broke even, they'd keep making more and more money. If you ask them, when a new kid shows up, how many dollars do you want? The answer is, we want the full 100%, not 40 or 50 or 60%. So if that same kid the next day says, never mind, I'm going to go, how much should that kid take with them by proportionality? The same 100%, because the state funds 100% of every marginal student. And that's the case from student N up through, you know, thousands, unless you got all the way down to their core local funding, which no school district has come near. And if they did, that would mean that local untouchable levy money, because not 1 cent of local levy money ever leaves the traditional school
district.
Well,
what is the constitutional threat? And I'm just... I'm not buying the mathematical argument that you guys
Sorry, Your Honor,
make.
It's in the statute.
I don't think you're correctly presenting it, but at any rate, what is the minimum threshold that would implicate the Constitution? If you took all the children out of the public school, would that...
Well,
at what point have you violated the thorough and efficient clause? Is there no standard that applies?
I think the question is this. First, if you say the thorough and efficient, that might be different from their Article 12 claim. And again, they do some blurring of which claim it is. Under the thorough and efficient clause, keep in mind that the money that is left when, or that is lost when a kid leaves to go to a community school is identical to if that kid went to a religious school. So if the thorough and efficient clause makes it unconstitutional to adjust the formula the way we do when a kid leaves for a community school, that would mean that same formula is unconstitutional for how we do district-to-district enrollment when you go to a neighboring from Columbus to Worthington, or when you go to a religious school. Because if you look on the form, when a kid leaves, all we ask is, oh, you have one less kid now. We never ask, where did the kid go? Oh, if they went to St. Mary's, we'll take this much. If they went to the community school, we'll take that much. There's nothing they can point to in the formula, in the statute. No amount of assertions and affidavits can change the fact that we don't know where the kid goes as long as you have one less kid. And so if it is somehow unconstitutional to lose $1, then it would be unconstitutional to take any money away. You'd have to say there's a constitutional mandate that once you achieve so many students, you can get more money when students arrive, but as students leave, we have to hold you harmless. That even if 20% of your kids move to Indiana, you have to stay the same. That can't be what the thorough and efficient clause means. The other thing is, as to the governance component of the thorough and efficient clause, I think Justice Stratton properly raised Article 6, Section 3. If they did have a claim here, it would be under Section 3, the separate city school district claim. Now, they don't, for a reason I'll get to in a minute. But how can we say Article 6, Section 2, the thorough and efficient clause, how could that require elected school boards for every district in Ohio as a matter of the Constitution in 1851? If that were true, why would the framers have come back a generation later, two generations later in 1912, and added a provision saying, for city school districts only, we're going to give you a right to control the size and shape of your school board? If everybody already had that right under the thorough and efficient clause throughout the state, they wouldn't need it to have added that provision. So the governance can't violate thorough and efficient. The only question then is, does the governance violate the separate clause in Section 3? And I think what Section 3 is about is, keep in mind there's different forms of accountability. There's answering to the legislature that funds you. There's answering to the voters that fund you. And when you're talking about levies and answering to the local voters, it makes sense to say, if you're a city school district and we're giving all this inside unvoted millage to you, we want to be able to vote for you. I want to vote for my Columbus School Board members as a city resident because I want to make sure that I know where they're spending my money. But if there's a separate pot of money coming straight from the General Assembly where the local dollars aren't being sent over there, well, then it makes sense that the accountability is achieved because I get to vote for my state rep and my state senator. I get to vote for the governor. The control of the local school board over levy funds is what animates the concerns in Section 3. But it can't be, again, how can it be a mandate of Section 2 of the Thorough and Efficient Clause to have school boards statewide if then all of a sudden 50 years later we say, oh, we're going to do that only for the cities? Those two, their claims sort of contradict each other there.
Mr. Carney, let me ask you a different question if I can. If I understood Mr. Mooney's position, it was that the system of common schools in Ohio requires a public school. That's his position. And these are private schools. And so he's saying it's sort of outside the system of common schools. Would you address that position?
Certainly. These are public schools. Let's look down the laundry list of things private schools don't do that these schools do. These schools have to follow even things like open meetings, public records law. Their teachers pay into STRS. Their teachers even have the right to organize if they want under Chapter 4117. That's all provided for in 3414. These schools are run by governing authorities that, to be sure, do have an appointment method of getting together and organizing differently. But then they apply for approval. They have to have a sponsor. And then the ODE sends funds, the Ohio Department of Education, and then offers oversight and regulation. And if a school doesn't cut it, you can cut them off. I mean, these schools face a stronger form of accountability than our traditional schools have ever known for 100 years because they face it at several layers. First and most important, if the children and students don't like it, or the students and parents don't like it, they leave. There goes their funding. The school dries up. Also, the sponsor can shut them down. Also, the school can step into the sponsor's shoes, or the state can step into the sponsor's shoes, and the state can shut them down. All that the other schools face are academic watch, they face report cards, they face adjustments of funding, but the shutdown, they can point to some horror stories of schools around the state that have shut down, but we don't see that as a sign of failure. That's a sign of success. It shows if you don't shut down, we're not going to keep sending kids and money there year after year. So they are public because no private school has to answer to all those things, public audits, the auditor, the public records law, everything. About the only form of governance that they can say is different is, but we don't elect the school board. And then that comes down to how can that be part of thorough and efficient?
Are they required to pay the teachers on the state minimum salary schedule?
I'm not sure if they fall. I don't think they fall under the same salary schedules. But again, think of how much diversity we have within the traditional public schools. Joint vocational districts, special ed schools, magnet schools, art-focused schools. If the system of standards meant full-scale uniformity, then the thorough and efficient clause would not only mean shutting down communities.
All those teachers have to be compensated at a minimum state rate, right?
Well, I don't think that they, I'm not sure. I know they do have to follow state teaching standards. They have to be certified, some of them temporarily, some of them permanently.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Carney. If we were to determine that this system as it's established does not comport with the requirements of the Constitution, would that make any difference to the legislature?
Well, it depends whether you're saying does not comport with the Constitution under Section 3 of Article 6 or under Section 2 or under Article 8. That's the problem in just saying the Constitution, because if, for example, the problem were Section 3 only, then the answer would ironically be you could have them everywhere but the city schools. You could set them up in rural areas. Maybe the city kids could even go over there, and drive out to Delaware County to go there. But they couldn't be if you found it on Section 3. If you found it on thorough and efficient grounds somehow, which we think would be a drastic mistake, then the answer would be why? If you say it's not thorough and efficient because of the standards, we'd have to order shutdowns of all these varieties of magnet schools and art schools, perhaps in the traditional schools, because some of their curriculum throughout the day in an art-focused school is a little different. It's not as the same as a school a few blocks away. If you say the problem is the funding, then we'd have to say, gee, maybe that means there's a constitutional mandate from the Supreme Court that we can't take a dollar away even if a kid goes over to St. Mary's. So when you say what would the legislature do if you found them unconstitutional, the question is how? If the opinion says one thing, it would mean radically shutting down pieces of the public traditional schools. If the opinion says another thing, it would mean radically changing the funding adjustments when you go to St. Mary's. So I can't really answer what can we do if you say unconstitutional without looking at any one of those. And that's where, as I said, the overarching principle is that their claim breaks down if you try to pin it to any one thing.
Is the state funding homeschooling today?
This, if you do true homeschooling, the state does not.
What's true homeschooling as opposed to false homeschooling?
Fill out the forms with, I don't mean to say any is false homeschooling. If you fill out certain forms with the superintendent and you notify, I'm homeschooling my child, you have to bring in a portfolio or take certain tasks. There are different alternate certifications. There's some, the term of art is used differently by different people out there in the discussions. There are people who have their children at home who are enrolled in online schools. In fact, some of the public school systems like Reynoldsburg runs an online school where kids from outside of Cleveland and all over can go to school. In that sense, they're not homeschooling in the formal sense. They're physically at home, but they're online, they're following the curriculum, they're following testing of whatever that cyber school is. But for sort of true homeschooling where you're not signed up through a community school, then you don't get any money. You know, if my wife and I homeschool our four-year-old next year, then no one's gonna send me $5,700.
So the ones that are signed up doing homeschooling, as you indicated, are receiving state money?
Well, again, I think they're not homeschooling. If they're a community school that sends them cyber instruction.
Maybe I'm not asking the right question. If someone signs up to a school like that online, does the state send a check? And if so, to whom?
It goes to the school. And then the school provides the lesson plans, the schools provide a computer, and the schools provide testing and reading your essays and grading them. So there's back and forth, you know, you email your assignments to your teachers, all that sort of thing, okay. Which again is something the traditional schools are doing as well through their own community school units.
Thank you.
Mr. Kearney, let me just ask you one last question. Do you agree with Mr. Mooney's estimate that there are only about 20 school districts that are sponsors of community schools?
No, I believe at the time of the record, there were at least 250 total community schools, of which about 50 were run by state traditional school districts, about 50. I don't know if that number has gone up or not, but I don't think it's dropped to 20. But in any event, the idea that they admit that those would be okay really shows that their funding argument can't be right, because they're traditional. If they have this other arm over here, their traditional school gets hit the same way when they send them to their own arm. So that shows that the funding argument isn't really the problem. And at the same time, the governance, again, it can't be part of Section 2, or why would we even have Section 3? I think at the end of the day, they need to win or lose on Section 3, which they fail for all the reasons in the brief. And finally, I just want to briefly note, and I know my red light's on, the Section 4 and 5 components, they even admit in all their headings, they say certain community schools have crossed the line from public to private. Certain schools have done this. Nowhere else in our jurisprudence do we say when certain people break the speed limit, that means the speed limit's the problem. They can address those under their statutory count 1, 2. All the claims in the trial court can address those. You don't need to send these constitutional claims back just to see whether certain people are breaking the statutes. That can be covered under the other counts. All of these counts should be ruled on as a matter of law, because again, nothing in the Constitution prevents us from giving parents and students a choice.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney. Mr. Mooney, you've used your time, but you may take a minute. See what you can do with a minute.
Let me very quickly say that I did check my notes. There are 48 conversion schools, which I think are schools that are created by school districts. And I think the difference is that when a school district creates a charter school, it can take into account where there is a special need in our community for a school, how many kids we will enroll there, whether it will have an adverse impact on other schools that are part of the system.
Does the legislature have the same opportunity?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Does the legislature have the same opportunity to decide to create those kinds of schools?
I think the legislature can give the authority to local school districts to create charter schools. I can imagine some situations where the legislature could create schools on its own that would be administered by public officials, that would be real public schools, but that's not what we have in this case. Answering Justice Pfeiffer's question about Cincinnati, in Cincinnati, a charter school student has $7,229 sent to it from the state to pay for that charter school student. The state pays $2,933, so it's less than half, to the Cincinnati public schools to pay for the children of Cincinnati public schools, forcing those of us who pay our local real estate taxes in Cincinnati to pay a higher burden, which is the exact
issue. So in the broad scheme of things, for every student that moves, it'd be more than the equivalent of two
Right.
In terms of state funding that is moved.
You know, it's more than twice as much. And you know, maybe they see it as a myth that my local property taxes go to pay for that. But if you look at the SF3 form, and if you pay property taxes in Cincinnati, it sure doesn't seem like a myth, because you've had to make up for it with higher taxes. The other problem with it is this, in terms of the thorough and efficient aspect of this. The state relies on those of us who pay real estate taxes and to vote for more and more taxes in city school districts around the country. Now, what happens, and those votes come from parents like me who send our kids to public schools. It might come from homeowners or property owners who know that an important thing to keep your property value up is a good public school system. But if your child goes to a charter school, and you know that regardless of how well the city public schools do, there's an incentive, there's no reason to vote for it, you're not going to vote for it. And we've seen in Cincinnati and other places around the state where charter school families and schools actually campaign against
the local property tax. Is that a constitutional issue? I mean, I
think it goes to the issue that I think probably needs to be remanded as to whether the funding of charter schools affects the state's ability to provide a thorough and efficient system of public education. I think those are the types of issues you looked at in DeRolf. But I think the key issue here in terms of our constitutional claim, the as-of-law constitutional claim, is these are not public schools because they're not publicly owned and administered. They're not subject to the same standards. And my reply brief goes into the No Child Left Behind statute, 3302.04F is the key language that's the accountability provision that apply to regular public schools. It says that if you don't make average yearly progress over 3 years, and the clock has been ticking since 2003 for regular public school districts, you can be subject to various sanctions like withholding public funds, replacing key district personnel, instituting new curriculum, alternative forms of governance, even appointing a trustee to manage the district. But charter schools are exempted from that key provision in the No Child Left Behind enacting language. Instead, they have what we've called accountability light, 3314.35, passed with the budget bill in 2005, which essentially says, well, for you guys, the clock starts ticking in the fall of 2006. Yes, they have to take the same test, but in terms of measuring your progress, we're going to have different types of norms that apply. And if you make progress, and they haven't even established these yet, maybe you start down here and you go up a little bit, you've satisfied the progress. They're not the same standards, and
so,
that's the defect.
So when the state argues that they have the same standards, they didn't have, and the testing, that kind of stuff, starts in 2006.
I think it depends on what you mean by the word standards. They've defined it as, well, you take some tests, those are the only standards. What we've said is standards include accountability. What happens if your kids don't achieve? And that's what they've been exempted from. That's where the separate standards are. The level of accountability is completely different for charter schools than it is for traditional public schools.
Mr. Mooney, your principal constitutional provisions are with respect to the thorough and efficient system and whether or not there's local control.
Right.
You aren't really pushing the issue about extending credit to state corporations under Article 8.
We're pushing it. I just didn't get a chance to talk about it. And I think there are two subsections there. I think you can look at that Article 8, Section 5 and says, well, these are corporations. Is there a famine, flood, war, natural disaster?
I understand.
They're not. You know, I don't think the word corporation is that ambiguous. The credit of the state shouldn't be extended to them. As to Article 8, Section 4, we believe that can and should be remanded if we are right that these private management companies dominate and control these schools and they're making a profit. Then I think there's a question of fact as to whether the payments, those individual schools, are violating not simply their articles of incorporation and the corporate law of Ohio, but whether payments to those schools that are dominated and controlled by management companies violate the Constitution.
Mr. Mooney, let me ask you, just not to prolong your agony here, but I want to make sure I understand your standards argument. If a traditional school district, as we know, many traditional school districts have various forms, various programs. Columbus School District, for a number of years, I don't know if we still have it or not, but had the Fort Hays Career Center for students who had particular talents in art or work with their hands, all that sort of thing. We have music schools, as we mentioned earlier, Montessori schools. I take it those programs, the success in those programs of a student in those programs, the success of a student is judged by a different standard. They take proficiency tests, as I understand all community schools. That's the basic, I call reading, writing, arithmetic. It's more than that. But essentially, the proficiency exams are, there's no question about those. Then we have the other programs that tend to attract and draw out in certain students the talents that they may have that the traditional, day-to-day school doesn't simply, the classroom simply doesn't feed them.
When you talk about standards,
the traditional schools, obviously, they're allowed to do this,
right,
have these special programs. How are the community schools different in that sense?
Well, I think that answers the question. If you can do it in a traditional public school, then the state law that applies to a traditional public school must allow it to be done, I think. I mean, I'm not, obviously, there may be some violations somewhere.
I would assume, I guess.
Right. I think when we're talking about standards, we're saying there's a specific provision in Article 3314 that says, except for as specifically enumerated here or in their contracts, community schools are exempt from all other state laws about education. I mean, I don't have the number in my head, but it's in the statute. And although they have been required to take most of the tests that regular public school kids take, the question is, where is the level of accountability that applies to regular public schools? There's also standards relating to fiscal management and other things that we've highlighted in our brief.
I took it from the briefs that it seemed to me that, and maybe we're talking about different accountability, but it seemed to me that the community schools actually are more accountable in the sense that they have to report to the parents and they have more auditing requirements. Am I getting the wrong impression from the briefs? Or
they have to give an annual report to the parents. It used to be that every parent got a report card generated by the state Department of Education, but for some reason when the law required that community schools be graded, such as academic emergency, the obligation to mail them the report card went away. I'm not sure exactly why. So they're not getting the report cards. And I guess it's right that parents can vote with their feet. And in Cincinnati, if you're not happy with your regular public school, you can go to a magnet school and some people move out. So that is true at public schools. But in terms of at community schools and regular public schools, but in terms of the shutting them down because of a poor academic performance, it hasn't happened yet. And under this law that's been enacted over the summer, the accountability light law, the clock doesn't begin ticking until 2006.
But again, isn't that, we're talking about the Constitution, that statute, isn't it?
Well, I think that
can be corrected easily by the General Assembly if it wants to correct it.
Well, I think what's important for the Constitution is, as the court ruled in DeRolf, a uniform, or rather a common system of public schools includes a uniform system of standards applicable throughout the state. And I think that statute shows that the uniform system does not apply to community schools.
Thank you, Mr. Mooney. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.